Hi, Ron Rivest from MIT. I wanted to make a statement and then ask a question and propose a metaphor and ask a response to it. So I feel in real life I have a right to absolute privacy in conversations. I have a conversation in my bedroom, or if I want to propose to you that we take a walk by the seashore and talk privately, or a walk in the woods and talk privately. I feel I have an absolute right to that as a citizen, and unless I'm a convicted felon and have to spend my time in jail. So one question, I guess, the first part of that, part A of my question is am I wrong in that? Second thing is the metaphor then. I think in cyberspace, this new world we're creating in cyberspace, it's like the Louisiana Purchase. And the, you know, it's a vast new world, and it's got its own seashores and woods in it. And the cryptographic technology provides those seashores and woods. When you suggest to me, why don't we use this cryptographic key to communicate with, you're saying, let's take a walk in these woods and talk privately. Let's walk by that seashore. And I think that what this law is saying is that those woods and those seashores are off limits. You know, what's wrong with that metaphor is my question.
Go ahead.
As to the first, let me say, you always run the risk that the person you're communicating with will, you know, she was kind, she was warm, she was understanding. Unfortunately, she was also wired for sound, right? That's Gary Trudeau. So you always run that risk, and the same is true when you're walking on the shoals. And when it comes to metaphors, I'm going to defer to Professor Frumkin here, who's an expert on metaphors.
Well, I guess the unfortunate thing is, I mean, much as I love metaphors and think they're probably the best way to think about these problems, I'm not sure the metaphor actually describes the state of the world today. I think maybe you're not right. You take a walk in the woods, and the government has lawful authority to do so. They can use a sonic mic to try to get you. All sorts of things they can do, and, well, you know, I very firmly believe that we ought to try to replicate the rights that we have in our ordinary lives, electronic communications.
If I can myself, they can try, but you know, I can walk, you know, very far away from any obvious sources of surveillance. This law strikes me as a requirement to wear a lapel mic to be wired myself.
Well, you know, as you know, I'm not a supporter of these laws. I wrote a long article explaining how I wanted to try to shoehorn that idea into the rather uncomfortable confines of the Supreme Court's precedents, which are reasonably unfriendly, surprisingly unfriendly to that idea. I started writing this 200-page article. I knew the answer. It was obviously unconstitutional. And my horror, as I wrote, was to discover how difficult it was to prove that, given the, you know, where we are today.
Thank you, Michael. Yes?
Hi, I'm Samir Parikh with Community Connection. I have a point about the key length issue, which you mentioned, and the absolute privacy. It's not really an issue of key length in regards to absolute privacy. You can use monstrous key lengths, but it still doesn't stop. Say I use a private system and the government suspects me of committing a crime. They have every right to get a warrant and search my computer and hire a hacker to break into my computer. I don't know the specifics, but they have every right to get a warrant if they want to try to find my communications. They can try. They can't force me to help them try to find the communications.
Unfortunately, they may be able to. I mean, the law right now is they may be able to force you now, as
well,
the law stands.
According to the statute, which is proposed.
What?
That, I mean, yeah, there's the compulsion of the key issue and all of that. But according to the statute, which requires me to give you the key in advance, that's giving you the ability to break into my computers before I have ever possibly committed a crime. And so it's not really an issue of absolute privacy, because you can try, and I'm not saying you can't try.
But at some key length, we recognize the fact that it's going to be extraordinarily difficult.
Well, it's not really a key length issue either, because it's not, say I use a lot of encryption on my computer, but there's, I mean, hopefully my computer is secure, but there are other problems. So any system isn't an issue of just the cryptography. It's an issue of the general system security. So you can't, if you have good cryptography, you don't necessarily still have good system security. So are you going to make it illegal for people to protect their computers in any sort of secure fashion?
I'll take that as a rhetorical question.
Okay.
By the way, I want to give the same disclaimer that Mike Frumkin gave at the beginning, which is don't confuse the advocate's message with the advocate's beliefs.
Thank you. I would ask that before we have people coming up twice to say something, that everybody be given a chance to say something once.
Sure. You should have let me. please identify yourself before you ask your question. The session is being recorded.
No. My question is for you people here. I have, my name is Colette Silvestri from the Senate of Pennsylvania. I have a question in the event, before even federal laws pass, rights reserved to the states. It seems you're all scrambling around looking for definitions of technologies which were not present in the times of the Founding Fathers. I'm just asking hypothetical stuff. I'm a researcher. Let's take the case that a state chose. We move one level up, okay? You're talking about individual talking with the federal government. And let's say we move level up. It's state government now discussing. We choose to defend our constituents. And we have the machine which our constituents could use to generate the number. It's a state-owned piece of property. You cannot define it in the Constitution. We do not want to release it to you. What do we do in a case like that? Can we be disobedient?
We have 2 minutes.
Well, unfortunately, the Supremacy Clause, there are a number of tools that the government has, that the federal government should choose to use it against the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in that case. Number one is the Supremacy Clause. It could invalidate it under the Supremacy Clause. The other thing, of course, it could tax you out of existence, as if it isn't doing it already.
Oh, okay.
It has the power to tax and spend and use all kinds of other leverage and persuasive powers. But as a matter of law, the Supremacy Clause would say that a state scheme which is inconsistent with a comprehensive federal scheme would fail.
Would it? Okay, that's what I want to know.
Thanks a lot. We only have 2 more minutes.
Okay, well, I'll try and keep it short. I view the role of government as sort of a dialogue with the people about what kind of world they'd like to create. And I kind of like the world that Ron would like to create. And I think it's too bad when anybody would stand up here and say, we have to accept the fact that it's not like that. In the spirit of negotiation, I'd be curious if the government representatives would like to comment on the issue of what is it exactly that you're offering for trade, in the sense that you're asking to take away a very specific thing which is very near and dear to all of us, and what is it you're offering in response? I don't believe that the answer is going to be that you'll get rid of kiddie porn and that you'll get rid of all international terrorism. So my assumption is that you're going to tell me that you'll reduce it from 15% to 13%. I want to understand why one is an acceptable level and one's not an acceptable level, and why that particular little change is worth what you're asking us to give up in response for that.
Fortunately, we're dealing with a theoretical statute which has not been passed. In theory, the government is saying there's an incremental assistance in the ability to investigate and prosecute criminal activity, and that the people of the United States through their elected representatives have decided that this incremental ability, additional ability to prevent crime, and I don't think you can even put a number. I think your 2% is way high, by the way, that is worth giving up a certain amount of rights. And that may be absolutely wrong. It may be absolutely wrong, and that's why you don't see this statute on the books right now.
Thank you. We have 1 minute.
There's a similar statute introduced by Senator Leahy 2 weeks ago. But anyway, I came up to offer a historical correction. In the days when the Bill of Rights was written, in fact, there was absolute privacy. Electricity had not been invented. Radio had not been invented. You could take a rowboat and row out into Boston Harbor, and nobody could hear you if you were beyond physical earshot. You could walk into the middle of a field and look all around you and have a private conversation. If the people who built the government had thought that it was within the rights, that within the proper powers of government to violate that, they would have said so.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Christine, I have a question for Andy Good and for Jeff Hermes. Where are you? All right. Jeff was one of the law students on the petitioner's brief, and I understand that Andy helped supervise the preparation of that brief. I was involved in helping to draft a scenario along with Mark Rottenberg from EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and one of the things that I was very surprised in was what I perceived to be an absence of a critical issue addressed by the petitioners. I'd like to know why, if there is a reason. and that is attempting to establish a right of individual privacy. More to the point, attempting to establish the right of an individual having a sphere of integrity that is separate and apart from any right that the government has to enforce its own mandates of protecting tranquility and national security. I didn't see any attempt to argue in that direction. And I'd like to put both of you on the spot right now. Why did you choose not to address that more aggressively than you actually did?
The primary reason why Chris and I, my partner on the brief, decided not to make a specific argument as to a general right of privacy was that, well, basically, according to the research that we did and according to the general case law, it would have been the weakest of the arguments we could have made. It would, of course, have been, nice to be able to make that argument. However, if you take a look at the case law in the background, every established right of privacy is contrasted with a corresponding governmental interest. The Supreme Court has been unwilling to declare that outside of the context of a specific constitutional amendment, first, fourth, fifth, that the that an individual can have a right of privacy which entirely overcomes any government interest. And in our evaluation, it would have been
to live independently of government interference. It's going to be very difficult despite what Jeff says about the law. What's interesting is that the government has influenced very heavily what the law is in its own favor. What's at play in this case is that as a practical matter, the technology may be making it impossible for the government to maintain that hegemony that it has achieved in the law, but not in practice. That trying, as Phil said, to dumb down the technology is ultimately a failed enterprise. It won't work. It's just not achievable. To require somebody to escrow a key, and then of course the first bright guy who says, "Well, here's a truckload of keys. Enjoy yourself." That's the end of that. We're now. This at one point we had telephony that was not digital. Now we have digital. Who knows what we'll have 15 or 20 years from now? I think that the reality is that conversational communications or any communications using these types of technology will become at some point impossible for the government to intercept effectively, and that's just the reality. That's just too damn bad. That's the way it's going to be. And whatever the law says about it, I don't think that the law ultimately has an end limit, and that is that you can't make all of us criminals. That ultimately the technology and the willingness and the ingenuity of people to develop these technologies is going to be impossible to control, and at that point we're just going to have to recognize. One thing that was said during the argument that I found interesting that Mark said was, or somebody said, there were 2,000 wiretaps last year, and we have to be able to do that same 2,000 or maybe 2,500 next year. Well, there were, I don't know how many trillions or however the number is, of conversations, communications that went on free of wiretaps. And the idea is that in order to for our government to be able to intercept 2,000 or 2,500 conversations, all of the rest of us have to register with the government so that they'll have the means to do that is upside down. So I think that the reality is that, practically speaking, the law is going to become irrelevant in this area.
Anybody? I know we got to go. I agree with Jeff that the trend of the law is clearly away from the right to privacy. It's being chipped away and so forth, and I think we ought to be all very afraid of presenting the Supreme Court with the ultimate issue, which is do citizens or even humans in general have a right to communicate with each other in absolute privacy? Eventually, the question is going to arise. In preparation for that, I think we should all pay a lot of attention to things like the Leahy bill, the digital telephony bill, and so forth, because if we don't, the political foundation will not exist to let the Supreme Court know which way it ought to go when it does set that policy, which is exactly what's going to happen.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Quite relevant to this discussion. We have Senator Conrad Burns from Montana, who is anxious to talk with all of us. That's me, not him. However, we've lost him. He's going to reappear in about 5 minutes. So what I'd like to encourage all of you to do is go out, grab a drink, do whatever you have to do, and come right back, really right back, so that you can all hear him. And he's going to talk about some legislation that he's got in the works, different from the Leahy bill, which John Gilmore mentioned. And he'll be also ready to take your questions. Thanks.
The 6th Annual Computers Freedom and Privacy Conference. Up here in Boston. We have a wonderful view of you on your worldwide web page. And as I said, we're very pleased to have you here, especially because, at least in my view, long before anyone in the world, with the exception of the people who come to this conference, knew about the Internet or knew about the potential of telecommunications infrastructure, which is what we used to call it then, you had legislation out as early as 1989, as I remember, that would have promoted the development of advanced telecommunications infrastructure. Now that the Congress and the President have finished with telecommunications reform, we're delighted that you're picking up the ball on this encryption issue, this issue that we really think is the most important issue for the development of the Internet, the most important public policy issue that we all face. We're delighted to have you here, and we look forward to your comments. I should just, so that you know who you're talking to and what you're fitting into here, we just had a 2-hour moot court on the subject of constitutional rights and encryption policy. We had a very distinguished panel of federal judges, actual federal judges, and everyone in the audience here has their minds focused quite squarely on the question of basic rights and encryption, and we're looking forward to hearing about your efforts.
Well, thank you very much, Danny. I appreciate that, and I hope everybody can hear me. Thanks for the nice invitation to come to Boston today, even though it may be through this wondrous thing called the telephone. But, you know, I got involved in telecommunications back in 1989, which when I come to the Congress, to the United States Senate, and it was pretty obvious to me why I got involved. Now, I've even got, but my background is agriculture. It was, in fact, principally it was livestock marketing. We're starting to video livestock now and sell it by video. But nonetheless, when I come here, I was a little bit concerned about those young folks who live in our rural areas of Montana. And of course, if you watch the news, no place is more rural than Jordan, Montana. And that's where we have the Freeman up there and a little bit of thing. But nonetheless, in Jordan, Montana, to give you an idea about the town, it's out there on the Big Dry Creek. The country is pretty flat, but then the Brousette to the west is towards the Missouri River into the Brakes country. And I used to cowboy that country, so I know it firsthand. But Jordan, Montana is the only city left in that county, Garfield County, that they still have a boarding school. In other words, the parents, the kids come to school on Monday morning. They stay there through Thursday night. Friday night, they go home. The high school, and there's only one high school and one grade school in a county that is larger than Rhode Island, but only a population of around 850 people. So that's what we're talking about in Montana, and why I got involved in telecommunications is because it deals with space. If you were to fly like a crow flies from Eureka, Montana to Alzada, Montana, it is further than it is from Chicago to Washington, D.C. So you see, we have to cover some spaces. Now, Massachusetts, I realize, is a large state up there, and I've been to Boston once, and I enjoyed myself up there quite a lot. But I will tell you, I think I'll go back, head back towards Big Sky Country. The best way I can figure out how to represent my constituency and all of Americans is that if we're going to have the internet, if we're going to do business on this great glass highway, then we're also on that highway is going to be intellectual properties and different properties and works of different people of all kinds of commerce will be done on this great highway. Well, to have the confidence in the consumer or the user of that highway, and also the user of a product, and then a provider or the maker of that product, we have to have confidence in the system that their rights are protected. And encryption is the only way that we do that. Right now, we're allowed to go up to 40 bits. Well, any hacker can break a 40-bit, as you well know. So in order to have confidence of doing business this new way, Montana, we have a lot of influence of people coming in from California, and they're doing business in Montana because they can do business with a computer and the fax and the telephone, but they also want to know that the properties or that they produce are protected and they get fair payment and there's some security about the work that they do. So it just means good sense to have this legislation, which would basically permit unrestricted export of mass market or public domain encryption programs, including such program or products as Pretty Good Privacy, popular worldwide web browsers. If it's available in your local software store or on the internet, then it ought to be exportable. It would also require the Secretary of Commerce to allow export of other encryption technologies to countries where products of similar strength are already available, and 3, it would prohibit the federal government from imposing mandatory key escrow encryption on the United States market and limit the authority of the Secretary of Commerce to set standards for encryption products. And I think the bill will just absolutely put more confidence into this great electronic explosion that we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years. Now, we don't know which direction this is moving, but we do know this. As long as the government stays out of it, the marketplace there'll be casualties, but there will be great winners, and the marketplace will make the determination of that. And that's the way it should be. Encryption actually enables that to happen. Those people who have their intellectual properties, their properties, they make sure that they're secure, but also the users have the confidence, and the consumers have the confidence that they're doing business in a confidential way. So basically, I can't tell you any more than that. I think it's very, very important. I think it's appropriate. We will announce tomorrow that I plan to introduce the United States Senate a bill to dramatically encourage the growth of electronics commerce and do away with this outdated regulations that prohibit the export of encryption technology. And we will do that tomorrow, and we hope that we have similar success with that. But, I just come downstairs from meeting. There's about 250 young people in the program here in Washington called Close Up. They're from Montana, and they're concerned, those young people, and these are all juniors and seniors in high school, and they're concerned about, will there be opportunities whenever they graduate their high schools and their schools for them? And I think the young people of today have a tremendous store of opportunities ahead of them, more than I had when I was a lad, because if you look at my life, well, don't look at it for any great example, but when you look at my life, the doors of opportunity look different, say, 40 years ago. Today, there's more of them, and they look a little bit different, but boy, I'll tell you what, there's great opportunities for these young people nowadays, and we've got to make sure that the infrastructure is there to make sure they can take advantage of it, and thank you again, once again, for asking me to do this today.
Senator, thank you very much. I want to know if you have time to take one or two questions.
Yeah.
Terrific. We've got a whole room full of people who, I think we've got over 500 people in this room.
Oh, if I'd known that many, I'd have got stage fright.
Okay. Well, that's why I didn't tell you until just now. We have the first question here. I think that the questioner ought to state the question, state who he is, and then I will repeat the question to you, Senator, so that you can answer.
Shabir Saftar from the Voters Telecommunications Watch. Senator, as I understand it, your bill would actually prohibit the government from pushing, promulgating, standardizing key escrow technologies. Is that right? And if so, how can we help?
The question is from Shabir Saftar, who is the head of Voters Telecommunications Watch, and he noted that he understands from your statement that the bill will prevent the government from standardizing on key escrow encryption technologies, and he wants to know how he can help and how all of us in this room can help you in your effort.
Well, I think we'll just sit down and visit with your congressmen and your senators in your local areas and lay it out in a very common sense way, a very simple way of why this is important that it could be done. Don't get too high-end technologies, because I'll tell you what, you're liable to run into a senator or a congressman that's kind of like me, you know, and they don't understand this too much. But I've been kicking it around for a while and sort of have an understanding for it. But that's how you help us more than anything else. I hate to tell you this, but I've got a very important call on the other line.
Is it 500 people, Senator?
I know, but I'm also on a conference of appropriations where we spend your money, and I've got to save a dam of all things.
Well, Senator, thank you so much for giving us your time, and we're delighted to be able to hear from you and look forward to your efforts in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for all your good help.
Thanks a lot. You're getting a big round of applause here.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone. I'm not sure what's next. Break. The magic word. Thank you all.